Information-fueled, opinion-driven. This is the Dan Mandis Show, Supertalk 99.7.
Man, is Hollywood having an oh crap moment? Good afternoon, 105 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Dan Mandis Show. 615-737-9986. 615-737-WWTN. Yeah, they can't figure it out. They cannot understand how is it that Roseanne is doing so well? How is it more people watch the revival of Roseanne, the first episode, then watch the end of Roseanne way back when? Now, full disclosure, I've never seen an episode. I know, I've never watched The Simpsons either. It's a weird thing. I just, living under a rock, whatever it is.
I quit.
After the show, knock yourself out. So yeah, Hollywood's trying to figure out now, okay, so what are we missing here? How is it that we have, I'm assuming Hollywood is saying to itself, how is it that we have made such a miscalculation on where the American people are today? Well, I think that's what they should have been asking themselves a long time ago. So to me, it's no surprise that you have Roseanne that is doing incredibly well, because this is the same America that voted in President Trump. But I love this from Deadline.com, because now what they're finding, this is because, you know, we've all known that over the past 24 hours, it was part of the news cycle that Roseanne did really, really well. You heard me, Michael, and I'm sure Phil and Brian talked about it too. But now what they're figuring out is where Roseanne did very well is just fascinating. So as we know, Roseanne made a triumphant return on Tuesday night, blowing past projections with a 5.2 ratings, adults 18 to 49, basically 18.2 million total viewers. Now, they talk about how nostalgia was expected to bring in some viewers. No one predicted such a huge turnout on premiere night. Well, guess what? This show that is decidedly pro-Donald Trump, with a Donald Trump-supporting protagonist, as they say, did really well. Did far better than they thought. And so there's something bigger at play here, I think Hollywood is now realizing. How quickly do you think there are going to be phones ringing and scripts starting to be written and all these other, however they get TV shows going, this is going to be the next rage? I would think, anyway. Maybe they bring back Tim Allen's show. But here's what we know. We know that while Hollywood certainly did not predict such a huge debut for Roseanne and the revival, we also know that they, and not a lot of folks, also predicted the Donald Trump victory. But Deadspin puts it this way. Both Trump and Roseanne were able to tap into the often overlooked and undeserved and underserved working class audience. That's exactly right. You know, we're not part of the elite class. You know, we don't live in places like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, all these highfalutin places. No. You know, we live in Nashville, Tennessee. And what they're finding is that people that live in some of these, as they say, underserved working class areas across America, those are the people that made Roseanne's revival such a huge success. Not surprisingly, the top TV markets where Roseanne delivered its highest ratings were in states handily carried by Trump in the election. Oh, it was just a bunch of deplorables who watched this show. This is fascinating. The biggest market where Roseanne was popular, where people watched this revival, was Tulsa, Oklahoma, which Trump won with 65.3% of the vote. This is where Michael spent 10 years of his radio career, was Tulsa, Oklahoma. And those people are Trump-supporting and apparently Roseanne-watching folks there in the great city of Tulsa. It was followed by Cincinnati, Ohio, and Kansas City, Missouri. They say the only marquee city from a blue state in the top 10 was Chicago at number 5. but we know that that is the area where the series is set. So isn't that interesting? So now, what does Hollywood have to do? What they need to do is they need to start realizing that, you know, there are a lot of so-called deplorables out here that are indeed underserved, and we are sick and tired of their liberal BS. Now, what's going to be interesting is in Hollywood, you would think anyway that it's all about the bottom line. So if they have now realized that the conservatives out here in America, that we are underserved, are they now going to start developing shows that cater towards a more conservative viewpoint? The top market of the country, New York City, was not even in the top 20. That's astounding. With all those people, New York's not even in the top 20. I think that shows you a couple of things. I think that shows you that the folks there in New York, in Los Angeles, was also not even in the top 30. So you got New York is number one, LA is number two, and neither one was in the top 20 and top 30, respectively. I wonder if that is indicative of an elitism that we find with folks in these particular cities. I think this is really interesting. They say that, and yet Roseanne delivered the highest demo rating for any comedy telecast in 3.5 years since the fall 2014 season premiere of TV's biggest comedy series in the last 5 years, The Big Bang Theory. And so they talk about the difference between nostalgia and curiosity and how the characters from the original series have changed and about the new generation of the Conners. Now, one of the things, and you know, the big update on the story is, of course, that President Trump apparently called Roseanne and congratulated her for such an amazing series premiere of this revival. But I think that what's interesting is one of the characters is decidedly anti-Trump. And see, I think that's a great thing, because one of the things that Roseanne has been saying, and again, I've never seen the actual show, but I do like Roseanne for a couple of different reasons. But bottom line is, she says, you know, one of the things that I want to do, she says, is I want to bring forward the ability to have a conversation. Because here's what we know about America these days. What we know about America is that it is really hard for people here in America to simply have a conversation. And that is really sad. And the reason why it's so sad is because we see this almost every single day, don't we? Don't we see almost every single day the inability here in America to simply have a conversation? Now, on the one hand, you have Sandra Bernhard, who apparently is also in the TV show Roseanne. She is decidedly against, it would appear anyway, about having a conversation. This is from Real Clear Politics. Now, again, think about it this way. Roseanne Barr said she wants to, with her show, if there's any goal, besides ratings and revenue, of course, which is on everybody's mind, it's to show America that there can be some sort of a conversation regarding politics. Sandra Bernhard apparently is also in the Roseanne show, and she was on, of all places, big shocker, MSNBC. And she is reprising her role as Nancy Bartlett Thomas on the reboot of Roseanne and the role that Trump plays in dividing the family. Because we know all about, and good Lord, did we talk about this during the election, about how pro-Trump and anti-Trump forces were dividing families all across America. I told you my own story. So Sandra Bernhard said that a lot of women have, quote unquote, compromised and given in by getting married and unfortunately don't have the luxury to think for themselves. That's a page right out of Hillary Clinton's book. She said these women must be, quote, under the thumb of their husbands. You've got to be kidding me. Think about the difference between what Roseanne has been saying and what Sandra Bernhard is saying. Who is the most tolerant party? Is it the left or is it the right? Is it the Republicans and the conservatives or the liberals and the Democrats? Roseanne wants to forward a conversation. Sandra Bernhard Women just can't think for themselves because they married oppressive men. Okay, it all makes sense now. It all makes sense. See, here's the thing about it. I love these stories. And the reason why I love these stories is because it exposes the left for what they are. Well, Dan, why do you talk about the left so much? Why do you talk about the liberals so much? Why do you give them airtime? Well, I do it because, one, they're a great source for show prep. Because they do dumb stuff. But it also, it has to do with the truth. And for the liberals and Sandra Bernhard and people of her ilk, this is their truth. This is the enlightened left. That women have compromised and given in by getting married and unfortunately don't have the luxury to think for themselves. She said these women must be under the thumb of their husbands. I wonder Hey, Belle, can you Google for me? Is Sandra Bernhard married? There's probably something about Sandra. Is she gay? Kind of tiptoeing around this. I don't know if she's gay. So clearly, Sandra Bernhard has a problem with women who are straight and also clearly men. And yeah, I had a suspicion about Sandra Bernhard, but I, you know, whatever. She said that women Trump voters must have felt inadequate compared to someone as educated as Hillary Clinton. And oh, good Lord. Someone as educated as Hillary Clinton, the woman who couldn't even figure out classified information. And she couldn't figure out the difference between classified and unclassified information. Really, Sandra Bernhard? Is that where you want to go? Because female Trump voters, they couldn't be educated themselves. Oh, no. Oh, my God. You know what's interesting about this? I found this on realclearpolitics.com. I don't know how widespread this is. I mean, maybe this is something that'll blow up in the next day or two. I literally just found this before I went on the air. So I don't know how much we're going to see of this across the interwebs and some of the mainstream media. Will they pick this up? Doubtful. Anyway, Sandra Bernhard says that women Trump voters must have felt inadequate compared to someone as educated as Hillary Clinton and just couldn't have brought themselves to vote for someone superior to them. Bernhard said that all that Hillary has accomplished is threatening to a lot of women, which turned them off to such a person. Wow. Good Lord. A lot of women, she says, have compromised, given in, raised their kids, and not had the luxury of being able to think for themselves. And when you sacrifice that in your life and say, I don't think I'm going to lean on somebody else financially, what that means is you've got to get up every day and go to work. She said, I guess this was yesterday on MSNBC. Oh, good Lord, folks. Is that not one of the most shocking things? You know, on the one hand, I think, good Lord, that's shocking. But on the other hand, it's really not shocking, is it? I mean, that's basically what Hillary said, right? When she went off to, what was it, India? I think it was India. And she essentially said the same thing. And that comment was on par with her deplorables comment. You know, maybe even worse than the deplorables comment. And now you've got Sandra Bernhard saying the same thing. And now look, just so we're clear. I could give two craps what Sandra Bernhard has to say. I really don't care. Because her opinion means absolutely nothing to me because her perspective is not one that I would agree with. And I'm be willing to bet that most of you don't agree with it either. However, you'll notice that, at least as far as I can tell, this is not necessarily something that's getting a lot of play in the media. Meantime, Hillary is back in New Jersey, apparently today. This is from NewJersey.com. And she is back for a, quote, sold-out event at Rutgers University. Now, the big headline on this is that she's going to be paid $25,000. But you know, bottom line is, for Hillary, that is a huge pay cut. I mean, it really is. I mean, if I remember right, she was getting, what, $100,000, $110,000, $120,000 per speech. Now she's getting all of $25,000. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, that's a lot of money for one speech, but when you're Hillary and you're as money-grubbing as she is, because we know she's money-grubbing, that's a pittance. if you're Hillary Clinton. Those are crumbs, to quote Nancy Pelosi. Anyway, they're saying that Hillary is back in New Jersey for a rare public appearance. I don't know. She's been making some public appearances. I guess if you could say that Hillary's making rare public appearances, I think it's because the Democrats are trying to bury this woman, at least her political career. I've been telling her, please, Hillary, just stop talking. Yeah, brace ourselves. Clinton is expected to talk politics, American democracy, and her role in shaping women's political history. Yeah, congratulations, Hillary. You lost to the world's most beatable candidate, Donald Trump. Congratulations on shaping women's political history. Rutgers is going to pay Clinton $25,000 from and by the way, just so you know, the reason that I said that Trump was the most beatable candidate in political history is because that's what people say about Donald Trump. Rutgers is going to pay Clinton $25,000 from an endowment, but use no money from tuition or state aid, blah, blah, blah. It is sold out, and if you want to watch it, you can on Rutgers University's live stream. Yeah, we'll see what Hillary has to say. We know that Clinton has railed against what she called Trump's reckless and dangerous agenda on the campaign trail in Blackwood in May 2016, was welcomed back to the state a short time later by rocker Jon Bon Jovi, a guy who is very much of a Hillary supporter. So it'll be Hillary, Bon Jovi, and perhaps Sandra Bernhardt and a whole bunch of elitist, enlightened college students there at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I'm reasonably certain that we will see some sort of news coming out of whatever Hillary has to say as she does this speech for $25,000 at Rutgers University. I think that maybe scheduled for today or at some point this week. It is at 121 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. .128 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Yeah, Matchbox 20. Now coming up, Matchbox 20. For the love of God, I hope I get better than this. Kyle Cook, lead guitarist for Matchbox 20, is coming up after the news, weather and traffic, all that good stuff here at the bottom of the hour at 1:35. Going to talk about something very cool that he is doing to help folks in need. And also going to talk about his life as a solo artist and also life and times with Matchbox 20. And so looking forward to that conversation coming up here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Again, right about 1:33, 1:34. Looking forward to that. Some of the stories that we have been talking about today, of course, Hollywood's oh crap moment, had a lot of people comment on that on the Facebook page and also sending me some private notes on Facebook and also some emails as well. I'll go over those in the 2 o'clock hour. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can on Twitter or Facebook at Dan Manda Show. And you can always, of course, always find me via email, Dan at 99.7WTN.com. Also, some folks commenting on the fact that Democrats are really split on what they should do with Donald Trump and his sex life and all of these affairs and alleged affairs as well. And so that's something the Democrats really need to figure out. And a lot of folks commenting on that as well. Looking forward to continuing those conversations as well. Straight ahead on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Again, you can find out all of the stories that I've been talking about today and a lot of the stories that I don't get to as well on the Dan Manda Show Facebook page. Got a lot more straight ahead. Take it home. 1:34, Super Talk 99.7 WTN, Dan Manda Show. That is the music of Kyle Cook, and the band is called Rivers and Rust. And of course, a lot of folks also, Kyle, know you as guitarist for Matchbox 20.
Really?
And yeah, I think so.
No. Sure, it's not the Goo Goo Dolls?
No, it is not the Goo Goo Dolls.
All right.
Although
I guess so.
Although, again, one of those very good bands from the 90s. But I've got to tell you, I've seen a Matchbox 20 several times, including one very memorable show way back. I don't want to make you feel old.
You're being kind.
2001 in Long Island, New York. And you played out some you know, amphitheater out there in Long Island.
Okay.
And it was just a great show.
Thank you. You know, we are fortunate to get to a place early in our career where we could really start, you know, thinking about the production and be able to put a lot of money into the production. And we always erred towards that, trying to keep tickets at a reasonable price, but putting more money into the show because we always felt like we wanted people to walk away, feeling pretty inspired by, you know, what they paid to come see. So that's good to hear.
Yeah, it was an amazing show. And I always thought Matchbox 20, I've seen you through the years. Working in radio, I'm lucky enough to get not only
we
free
were a radio
tickets,
band
but,
first, yeah.
I oh, mean, you sure
like,
were in the
we
90s,
always get
weren't
that,
you?
Like, that seems to be an adjective that's always you know attached to us. You
know what's interesting, though, and I got a question for you, and we're going to talk about the very good reason why, although are you living in Nashville now?
I am living in Nashville. Okay, I've been here for about 13 years, yeah.
Okay, great. So so many things I want to talk to you about. But
okay, cool.
One of the things you just said is the fact that you have that radio friendly reputation Matchbox 20 did, right?
Yeah.
It does, indeed.
Right, yeah.
Why do so many bands find that as almost like an insult? Like I'm going to give you an example. Like bands like Journey and some of these other more commercially successful bands.
Yeah.
They find that is almost like an insult when somebody says they are commercially friendly.
Well, because I think that it just I think it's just in direct defiance of the idea that, you know, you create art because it comes kind of from within you, either an emotional place or an inspirational place that has nothing to do with how much profit you're going to make from it, you know? Mm-hmm. Not to be too analytical, but I think that's why inherently a lot of artists do kind of – it's a love-hate thing, right? They want to be able to reach as many people as they can, and they want to have a viable career, and they want to be, because it's hard to make money in music. I mean, it's hard to make money in art.
Yeah.
So, once you get there, it's kind of easy to look back and go, it shouldn't be about that. You know,
right.
It shouldn't be about. It should be just about the merit of the art and the construction of the art. So.
But see, when you're writing a song, you're not. I'm assuming anyway, you're not writing it thinking, oh, I bet you we can sell, you know, a million downloads or a million albums or whatever it is. You're bringing a certain style and a certain influence to your music. And if it happens to have a great hook and so forth, well, that's good. But
we are in Music City and we are very close to Music Row here.
Yes,
so
we are.
Watch your tongue. I think ideally that's how you want to create music, right? You want it to come from a place that isn't driven by any kind of profit seeking.
Yeah.
But I'd like to agree with you and say that that's always the case. But yeah. But I just happen to know that, you know, like we live in a town where people get together to write songs by appointment. And to say that, you know, they're not trying to develop hooks or I'm not trying to like bash people. I'm really
sure.
Not. But it's just a fact. I mean, you know, sometimes in the same way that, you know, Hollywood is – you know, they're working on movies that they think are going to reach a certain demographic in the same way that television is going to air a certain show that they think, you know, an age group between 24 and 35 is going to like. Or, you know what I mean? I think both of those things work. I think great art comes from both of those processes. So I think I'm now, as a 42-year-old guy, like, you know, accepting of both of them.
Yeah.
And both of them produce crap. And both of them – you know, produce really great, meaningful, long-lasting art.
Yeah.
So,
and when
I just think some people don't have a hard
and
time.
And when Matchbox 20 is really starting to hit, I mean, I just looked up your hit songs, of course, and it's all coming back to me now, of course. If
it's
You're Gone, 3 a.m., Unwell, I mean, all these just great songs. When
Thanks.
You're writing those songs, do you realize that you're writing a hit at a time? Do you – you're putting words to paper and you're in the studio and you're thinking, man, this is really good.
Right. I think – yeah. Sometimes I do feel that. But, you know, in terms of our catalog, I got to give most of the credit and direct that question to Rob because he wrote the large percentage of the singles and the songs that are familiar to people. And he's just a really prolific writer and fantastic writer. He just has a great – sensibility about melodic, melodic sense and lyrical sense.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think sometimes you do, you know, I do sometimes you think, but I think sometimes you're wrong. Like, for instance, the first record, when I say you, I mean, you know, the artist, Long Day on that first album that's now ended up, you know, as Diamond. And it's like, I think it's like 13 million copies.
Holy
I think
that's
sold like internationally. Yeah. Long Day was the first single, which was kind of a flop, and everybody kind of felt like that was going to be a big hit.
Yeah.
and it wasn't. And then a song called Push kind of followed it and kind of almost ate the United States for a second there. It seemed like we just, everyone fell into the void of, you know. And so, you know, and then also I remember the second record was a song called Bent that, you know, maybe didn't test well, and everybody thought this other song was going to be the single. So, you know, I think sometimes you really do feel like you have something and it doesn't resonate. And then sometimes you're right.
Now, when you got Matchbox 20, had the great initial album, and then was there a lot of pressure, and is there a lot of pressure, generally speaking? You have that great album that has, you know, multiple singles, and everybody loves it. Then you do the tour, and everybody loves you.
Yeah.
There's got to be intense pressure to match that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there was pressure that we put on ourselves, but honestly, monetarily, I mean, you know, we were completely a flood with funding to do whatever we wanted for that second record.
Yeah.
We spent three times as long on it in a better studio, bigger studio, you know, brought in orchestras and horn sections, and we could do we could entertain any little whim that we wanted. So honestly, I don't think, and we'd made a bunch of money, so I didn't feel a lot of pressure, honestly. But I think, you know, I guess maybe to have those quote unquote commercial radio hits, maybe we did a little bit, because it's sort of like, whoa, now we're spending all this money, so Atlantic's really going to want to make their money back here.
Right.
We got to really deliver. And sales were starting, I think we were more concerned about that because physical sales were starting to slide at that point.
Okay.
You got to figure that first album with some great material on it, and it resonated for a reason, but physical product was still a thing.
Yeah.
So you were people were buying a lot of CDs. So I think it had a lot to do with it as well.
Now, did you start to freak out when Rob Thomas, and I'm just asking behind the scenes, you know, because I find this stuff fascinating.
I really do.
Rob Thomas is all of a sudden, he's recording with lead singer of Matchbox 20.
Right, right.
He's
the Santana thing.
Yeah, the Santana thing. And I think there was, he also recorded with a female artist whose name escapes me right now. I can't remember her name, but there was some, I can't remember who it was.
I can't remember that either.
Yeah, but anyway, he's all of a sudden doing all of these solo things.
Which makes sense, right? Because we were on top of the world. So it was like, you know, when you look up at the top of the mountain, you're like, well, we need to have this guy.
Yeah. Did that start to freak out everybody else because the lead singer is now doing things solo and now everybody else in the band is like, you know, maybe having a uh-oh moment?
Yeah, I think that's a natural reaction, right?
I mean, maybe
job security, anxiety or something. Like, okay, now we're not relevant, you know? Like, he's going to be swept away by the label and everybody else, and people are going to only associate all the positive things about the band with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I mean, obviously he was the most visible and still is the most visible aspect of the group, so that's just the nature of, you know, fronting a band. So I think, I mean, but we were, you know, we had done so well at that point.
Yeah.
So there was really no indication. He always, he never wanted to not, be a member of the group. But he did, you know, he did want to explore a lot of material that he was writing that he didn't feel was right for the band. So everyone understood that. So we always just looked at it as, you know, these hiatuses are gonna occur. Yeah. But there was never any real, there was never a really hard end like some bands, like the Eagles or something. There was never any, or the Beatles. There was never any real... this thing's over, but it's like, I'm going to explore this now. And, as a friend and somebody you respect, you go, you know, no one blamed him for wanting to explore,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if, I'm trying to remember the, Davis, the big record exec guy that, Clive Davis,
yeah.
You know, Clive Davis reaches out to you and says, you know, I want you to feature on this thing. And it's a Santana record.
Right. Awesome.
I mean, like who could blame him for wanting to have explored that?
It is interesting though, because I've interviewed a lot of musicians and so forth, and so it is interesting how there will be rivalries within a band that can destroy that band. So it sounds like at least
a lot of ego in the band. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, at least with you, it sounds like it was all.
We butt a lot of, you know, we butt heads in the studio creatively about which song should be on an album or which song should be explored or which, you know, the arrangement's not right or, you know, lyrics are not good enough. And so, but I'd like to believe that maybe that's what made us last, because we care on that level. And the creative energy is combative enough to actually make it better maybe than it would have been had we just been like, okay, whatever, you want to do that song, great.
Well, what's interesting too is with you is You have the solo project now. Mm-hmm. You have Rivers and Rust,
yeah.
And you also perform solo.
That's right. Yeah, both of those are aspects of what I'm doing outside the group. Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about Rivers and Rust, because
okay.
I've listened to a couple of tracks mm-hmm. in preparation for this. And how would you though describe the music of Rivers and Rust? Because I'm far from a musician, but to me it sounds sort of like a sultry mm-hmm. country and,
yeah.
and rock, and it's just, I really like it.
Yeah, thank you. I've always loved blues, and you know, country is kind of an extension of blues. You know, some people call it the white blues. You know, it stems from bluegrass. And I'm somewhat of an archivist, and sometimes that's a bad thing when it comes to going into the studio and trying to, you know, it's just like people always want to sort of go, well, what's the goal here? What's the genre?
Yeah.
But I was looking for a way to have that pop sensibility, but really start bringing in some of the country flavors, the bluesy flavors, and some of the soulful R&B flavors that I love. I lived in Atlanta for a while, really soaked that up when I went to an art institute when I had moved from Indiana, and started to get more into jazz and start to explore like chordal structures that are, you know, maybe a little more exotic. And so I wanted to figure out, I wanted to find a band that I could continually collaborate with females on, and the yin and yang of having the female voice in it
sure.
was really interesting to me. And I, you know, I have a studio over in Woodbine, and so I had the luxury of kind of just developing the tracks and working on it. And that was really one of the bases behind Rivers and Rust. So it's going to be an ongoing collaborative thing with a variety of different female vocalists. But I think what we're going to hear right now is Sheila Marshall's singing with me here.
Yeah. Well, what's your name, real quick, again?
What, Sheila Marshall?
Sheila Marshall. Yes, yeah, this is really good.
Texas singer-songwriter, yeah.
Play a little bit of that, Bill, if you would. So that's called, apparently, Welcome to the Show.
Yeah, that's right.
And how did you decide upon this kind of a format where it's you and a female collaborator and a female co-singer, I guess?
Well, because I met her. I'd produced some stuff for her, so it started there. I produced some stuff and I love working and arranging with other artists and bands.
Okay.
So that's something that I do also outside the group is
okay.
not only write songs but produce. And so it kind of started there, and then the sound kind of emerged. And so, you know, I brought the idea up to her of this Rivers and Rust. Well, we were looking for a name, and that came later. But the idea of this. And for me, one thing that was interesting about having been in a band, you know, 20 years harmonizing with Rob for the most part and occasionally singing some lead there's a certain range that you can't get out of when it's an all-male band, you know?
Yeah.
And so living in Nashville and having a lot of friends that were seeing a lot of, like, male-female groups, the range that you have there as far as keys and material, the breadth of the material that you can kind of work on widens a lot. So that really interested me a lot. So that's kind of really the core idea is to sort of give it – more breadth, you know, but also the Rivers and Rust, the clean and the dirty kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of flexibility
slick,
you have.
But,
so,
you know,
Now you guys perform around Nashville?
Well, the last show we did was City Winery. That was a couple years ago. And, I'm still working on new material.
Yeah.
As we're slowly putting things out and also a solo record. So I'm toggling a bunch
of
different
things. So
I don't have any solo stuff for you because that record's not coming out until fall.
But describe for me what the solo record's going to be like.
Okay, so the it's pretty dark. It's pretty dark. I'll be really honest. It's called Wolves. And it really – at the time that I was writing, it was kind of really cathartic, and it wasn't the kind of record that you set out to write that you just kind of need to write. Just like needing to shed skin or something. And so
was there something
pretty
going,
heavy. Yeah,
was there something
yeah.
going
so
on
my
in
wife
your life,
and I, my wife and I's relationship, you know, kind of came to a halt about 2 years ago, and it's really just documents the demise of that, and really to no small percentage due to substance abuse, and so which is you know in this industry, right? It's just
a
constant. Both of us. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Both of us.
Okay.
But yeah, so she lives out in California right now, and you know she's been in and out of rehabs, and she's still fighting it in a way that I couldn't help her anymore.
Yeah.
And so this album at the time in the throes of it was a tough thing to address because we are in the middle of it. Now that I have some distance from it, and you know, we've been separated for this long, I felt like, okay, now it's time to kind of really finish this album and put it out there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm hoping that the fans will take it for what it is, you know, a documentative album, not trying to exploit, you know, I hope some people don't look at it like an exploitative in an exploitative way.
Right. Well, no, that's what music is, right? It's all about you and your emotions and what you're going through, and that's relatable to so many people.
Yeah, yeah. So it's heavy, and a lot of it's really, like, specific and literal. And so, I'd love to. I'm trying to get her to explore the idea of a documentary that would go along with it, to pair with it in the fall that would help, that could be something that could help people. And ultimately that's where the positive aspect of the record I think can come from is that some sort of healing and that other people can take it into their lives and go, okay, I know somebody that's struggling with this as well.
Now with great talent comes great responsibility. And this is one of those times where you, Kyle Cook, lead guitarist for Matchbox 20 are doing something great. And that's an event called United by Hope, and essentially it's a Man and Woman of the Year campaign. Mm-hmm. It's all about helping folks with leukemia. It's in
Absolutely.
Support of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and their mission to cure blood diseases and so forth.
Yeah.
So what exactly is happening?
Okay, so on April 3rd, I think doors are at 6, we're at it's a songwriting event, more or less. There's a lot of stories involved, and it's at the Pleasant Hill Mansion. In Brentwood.
Very nice.
And it's a lovely, lovely setting. And Scott Stapp from the group Creed is there. Austin Jinks was one of the runners up on The Voice.
Yep.
And I believe Shay Mooney from the
Dana
duo
Shay.
Dana Shay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Should be a nice evening of stories and sort of quiet, you know, quiet storytelling, which is something that's really appropriate, you know, to Nashville or something. Relatable here in Nashville. It happens quite often. So
it sounds like an amazing event, and folks can come to the event and be able to, you know, help out a great cause and hear some amazing songwriters and amazing storytelling as well.
Yeah.
And where can folks find more information on this concert? It's mwoy.org/Tennessee/Nashville. And what I will do is I will put it on the Dan Mandis Show Facebook page, and people
Beautiful.
Can find it there as well. And
Beautiful.
Do you have a website?
Yeah, I do. KyleCookMusic.com. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah. So I'm going to start in Fort Lauderdale on my little solo run that I just was out all March, and I'm taking a week off to do this, and then I'm starting back in Florida. But yeah, all those dates are on KyleCookMusic.com.
Kyle, thank you very much, and thank you for doing something
Dan.
Great for folks, and I look forward to having you back in.
Yeah, I want to come back and talk politics, man.
Absolutely. 154
All right.
on WTN.